Chapter 20. Tuesday, July 2nd through Tuesday, July 9th, 1776. The Congress have judged it necessary to dissolve the connection between Great Britain and the American colonies, and to declare them free and independent states. As you will perceive by the enclosed declaration, I am directed to request you have it proclaimed at the head of the army in the way you shall think most proper. Letter from John Hancock, President of the Continental Congress, to General George Washington. That week unspooled slowly with hot days and muggy, breathless nights. Militia units from the surrounding colonies piled into the city. Ordinary folks skedaddled out of it as fast as their horse or feet would carry them. The extra soldiers were not the cleanest sort, or maybe they were too busy drilling and making gunpowder cartridges to wash. Whatever the cause, New York soon smelled like a garbage pit mixed with a fresh mountain of manure, the stench cooked under the midsummer sun. Madam's moods changed with the tide. One moment she floated on clouds of fancy, imagining her grand life once the British beat the rebels. Next she fell into melancholy, grumbling about the lazy British commanders floating at anchor off Staten Island, observing New York through long spyglasses but making no move to invade. She now carried with her a brocade pouch suspended from a red satin cord. Within the pouch lay a green flask filled with a calming elixir prescribed by the doctor. He advised her to drink from it whenever the need arose. She also took to walking around the house in her stocking feet, trying to catch me unawares as I scrubbed or dusted or polished, often with Ruth at my side. She said nothing during these encounters, but watched us with hungry hawk eyes. It unnerved me. The week after Hickey's hanging, Becky suffered a mild attack of the ague that had befallen so many soldiers. She grew pale and sweaty, but did not require purging or leeches. In her stead, I went to the market. Our needs were fewer now that we no longer fed the master and his companions. 'Twas a good thing, for farmers were afeard to come into the city, and there was less to choose from. More people fled every day, including the wives of General Washington and Colonel Knox and Brigadier Greene, her that folks said was such a big flirt. I searched for Corzine every day, but Bellingham's affairs kept him out of sight. I was afraid to seek out Colonel Reagan, afraid that word would get back to Madam and our lives be put in jeopardy. 10 days after the British flooded the river with their ships, news that the Congress had declared independence arrived in New York. The declaration was read to the troops from the steps of City Hall. The men cheered so loud it seemed to shake the whole island. I hurried from the egg cellar to see the cause of the commotion. The cheering men danced and marched down Broadway, tossing their hats into the air and shouting across the river at the silent ships of England. They gathered into a mob on the bowling green around the massive statue of King George III. I stayed at the edge of the crowd, hoping for a glimpse of Corzine or a soldier familiar from my visit to the battery. The king was mounted on his horse, and the horse mounted on a white marble pedestal that rose to the height of 3 men standing one atop the other. Both the horse and the men were fashioned larger than could be possible, but I suppose that was the way of kings. They were both made of gold that sometimes glittered in the sunlight but dulled when the clouds interfered. Ropes appeared as if conjured, thick ropes used for tying ships to the docks. The men cheered louder and worked together to throw the ropes over the king and his horse and tie them tightly. 1, 2, 3, heave! 1, 2, 3, heave! The men strained their arms and backs. Boys on the edge of the crowd jumped up and down. Common folk stood froze at the sight of a king being pulled down by the strength of the men working together. 1, 2, 3, heave! The statue toppled, slowly at first, then gaining speed as the weight fell from the sky to the ground. The men scrambled out of the way, no one wishing to be crushed by a fallen king. As it crashed, they shouted even louder and swarmed over the thing. Axes were called for and rushed out of workshops and up from the barracks. A half dozen men took to chopping the king and his steed to bits. I inched closer. How could they be chopping through a statue with simple axes? A piece of tail broke off, and a soldier held it up for all to see. The king was not made of gold, but of soft lead covered with gilt paint. The crowd shouted again, as another soldier lifted the king's head freshly removed from his neck. A fife and drum corps started playing just beyond the mob, piping out the song usually heard during a tar and feathering party. The men made short work of King George. When the statue was reduced into pieces that could be easily carted off, they did just that. The plan was to melt down all the lead into bullets.
"We'll fire Majesty at the Redcoats," joked a man with a booming voice.
"Aye," said his companion, shouldering an axe. "Emanations from Lead and George will make deep impressions on the enemy."
As the crowd marched off to make bullets and celebrate liberty and independence in the taverns, I realized dark was fast falling and I had tarried overly long. I picked up a sliver of lead that lay in the street. It was fringed with gilt, my own piece of majesty. Tyrants beware, I thought as I put it in my pocket.